On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for December 15th, 2016, the Red Dawn edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura, Emily Bazelon. We're in the same room.
Yay.
Hello, Emily.
Hello.
Slate's New York studio of the New York Times Magazine still, yes?
Indeed.
Good.
Not fired yet.
Not fired yet. That's everyone's motto.
Exactly.
John Dickerson, you still hosting Face the Nation, John?
I am.
Are you in D.C.? Where are you?
You're in D.C.? I'm in D.C. I'm in this lovely studio just all by myself.
We miss you.
Well, I miss you.
On this week's GabFest, the Russian hacking scandal and President-elect Trump's appalling response to it. Then the selection of Rex Tillerson as the presumptive Secretary of State. What kind of Secretary of State would he be? What did the selection process tell us about Trump? Then Ta-Nehisi Coates of The Atlantic will join us to talk about his new cover story on Obama as a black president. Ta-Nehisi, always a great colleague to have on the show. That'll be fun. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. And for Slate Plus, should you go to journalism school, that'll be a narrow cast topic, but it will take larger issues. So even if you're not planning to go to journalism school, you might want to listen to that. And if you are not yet a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus. To all the cozy bears listening in, Do svidaniya, the Russian hacking scandal exploded this week with news that the CIA has decided that government-backed hackers in Russia didn't really try to disrupt the election. They did so with a specific aim of harming Hillary Clinton and electing Donald Trump. This was based on new evidence that we'll talk about that has leaked out. Trump responded to this revelation by attacking the intelligence agency investigation, attacking the CIA. There is, meanwhile, movement to get a congressional investigation, bipartisan congressional investigation of this scandal, even as the president himself speed medals to get a complete review done before he leaves office in January. This, I think, story has three parts. It has the what did the Russians do part. It has the what are the politics of investigating and commenting on it. And is there anything we can do about it? Piece. Those are all sort of big pieces. So, Emily, basically, what did the Russians do according to reports?
The Russians, as we know, hacked into the DNC and also the DCCC. John, what does that stand for? Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Thank you. There was one more C in there.
The D-trip.
Okay. We knew all this before. They hacked gazillion emails that leaked out during the campaign. What we've also learned more recently is that they hacked into the RNC, according to the CIA, and decided not to release any of what they found. So presumably there's some treasure trove of RNC communications that are stashed away somewhere in the cloud. And so based on this and what they called a lot of circumstantial evidence, a kind of swell of circumstantial evidence, the CIA made this conclusion that the Russians were trying to get Donald Trump elected. And then most recently, there were more leaks from the CIA saying that Putin was personally involved in all of this. So, yeah, so there we are. Giant hacks. Russian, very successful cyber warfare with, as yet, no response that we know of from the United States.
John, there was a really interesting point made, and I can't remember where I read this, which was the line on this has been the Russians hacked the election, but they didn't hack the election. The piece I was reading said they hacked the voters. They hacked us. Yeah. It wasn't that the voting machines weren't corrupted, as far as we know. It wasn't they didn't suppress turnout by propaganda campaigns telling people to vote on Wednesday instead of Tuesday. It was that they changed behavior. if we assume that this is true, and in fact, what the CIA is alleging is true, so let's posit that. How did they manipulate us?
The Russians have followed this pattern before, which is they create chaos and sow doubt in everything so that, A, that's chaos, and people believe what they want to believe. And so they give them lots of things that they can people can go believe. And the way they hacked the electorate or us is that, A, they created chaos that the press can go cover. And then, B, for readers, they created false news stories or titillating news stories, well, that, A, hurt one candidate, but then also then just distracted, just kept everybody on the boil. And that sense of chaos both disrupts the process, and then secondarily, the Russians can then point, if the U.S. ever wants to make a moral claim that Putin is rigging his own election or operating outside of international norms, he can just say, well, look at the U.S. I mean, their election was totally messed up and they were saying all these things in private emails. So don't tell us how to behave. So it has that secondary benefit. Quickly, just one other thing that is a part of the story that the Donald Trump's response to the CIA here by saying the response from the Trump administration was basically, or the Trump transition was, these are the guys who got the Iraq WMD wrong. That's it's a traditional Trump response to the things that are most threatening, which is to challenge the motives and the capacity of the people making the claim. You know, remember when former Defense Secretary Gates said something critical about Trump, Trump said, oh, well, there's something wrong with him. That's an incredible thing to do with your intelligence agencies that you're about to go work with, to discredit them by talking about their worst failure in 15 years. And that has long-term implications. Usually administrations don't want to be in a fight with the intelligence guys, because the intelligence guys are pretty good at fighting back.
I just don't understand why Trump didn't realize, like, the best play is to support a bipartisan investigation. He's president. He's going to be president. Like, why? Why
no,
cause that destruction?
Too big a blow to his ego. He's been
insisting.
Well,
that's why. Yes, it's his ego thing.
Right. But if you see his narcissism is driving him, there was no way he could concede to this because it calls his legitimacy and his sweeping, wild, false claims of a huge landslide into total doubt.
Yeah. No, that's all true. One of the most demoralizing things about this, Emily, as John was getting at, is the way our own institutions have been turned against us, that it wasn't simply that this information was stolen. It was stolen, released through WikiLeaks, and then the American press primarily combed through it, turned it into story after story after story after story after story after story. And that became the drip, drip, drip that undermined trust in the election, undermined trust in Hillary Clinton. But it was the very strength of us, the free press, the openness and transparency that serve to undermine us.
Right. So they exploited our free press and we played right into their hands and they got what they wanted. And there's something really disconcerting about that. And, you know, whatever your position on Russia is, apart from this, a breach like this where you're interfering with a country's election and seemingly to achieve a particular result. But even if you're going to doubt that part of it, because there's some debate between the FBI and CIA about whether they were deliberately trying to elect Trump, even if you're just concerned about the diminishing of the integrity of our process and the attempt to manipulate people, that is a huge fact, a huge thought. I'm still having trouble getting my mind the idea that Russia essentially tried to throw our election.
Did. What do you mean tried?
Well, right. Okay.
Tried.
And did. Russia.
It was
you could say that there are lots of other factors.
Of course, there are lots of other factors, but
yes.
It was a very small margin.
77,000 votes.
Margin.
Yeah.
And there's simply no doubt that this, had this not been a story, Hillary Clinton would have one.
Right. I mean, I think
there's no doubt. Too far when you say no doubt.
No doubt.
Make that case.
When it's this close, you can say that about a number of different factors.
Right.
Right.
That's right.
Yes.
You're right. Yes.
I'm not
you're
saying
right.
It was
but
the only
that,
thing
but
that affected her losing.
But you can argue that simply because it was one of several things that it was definitive. I think that's pretty
right. In the same way, Ralph Nader didn't cost Al Gore the 2000 election, but absent Ralph Nader, Al Gore would have won the 2000 election. it was one of several things which was conclusory in causing Al Gore, who ought to have won that election, to lose. I think that.
But isn't the response to that that the Russians didn't keep Hillary Clinton from going to Wisconsin? I mean, it's not the Russians who did that, and she lost Wisconsin. I mean, I think
of course, yes, of course, she made several mistakes. But when you think that this is essentially a very small margin, that the strong bias was for Hillary Clinton to win. It was a very small margin. And were there things, obvious things that happened that suppressed Hillary Clinton's vote or increased Donald Trump's vote that were independent of things that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were doing? Yeah, this was one. This massively affected how people were perceiving the election. I don't have any question in my mind that this suppressed turnout enough across the country that it cost Hillary Clinton the election.
So that's unbelievable to me. And then there are two other things that are unbelievable. Donald Trump is denying not only the fact that the Russians were trying to help him, but that it was the Russians who were doing the hack, even though the whole intelligence community seems to agree on that. And questioning, and we haven't done anything. As far as we know, there's been no response from the United States. Nothing we know of to try to deter this in the future. And I find that really terrifying.
I don't follow to, you know, this was this cost Hillary Clinton the election. But I think one thing, if you are going to make that case, I think one other wrinkle to it is that it's not just that it suppressed votes. I mean, there are two things, obviously, two big things that happened. There was the hack and then there was Comey. I think what happened with Comey, one of the things is that people who were reluctant to vote for Donald Trump were then given afresh in the last week a reminder of all of the drama that would be surround Hillary Clinton.
Right.
So that's not really suppression. It's kind of just, if one of the keys in this election for Republicans was taking public focus off of Donald Trump, that's what the WikiLeaks thing did. And that's what. So I guess that's just another nuance. If you're going to make that case, which I still don't think you can make as definitively as you do.
Anyway. Right. And actually to compound that, is that because there was also an email scandal involving Hillary Clinton, involving her actual real misbehavior, people conflated all the things that were coming out in WikiLeaks. I think people, if you'd polled Americans, they would have a hard time distinguishing the WikiLeaks email leaks and the Hillary Clinton email leaks. It's all like there's something wrong with how Hillary Clinton is dealing with electronic communications. We're just learning about it. Look, every day there's another story about it. And some of it had to do with stupid stuff she did as Secretary of State, and some of it had to do with a hack, but it all sort of boiled into a noxious stew of Hillary Clinton is handling this badly. I want to ask one press question about this. Did the media, and obviously it's not a monolithic media, but in general, did the media do wrong by covering what was coming out in WikiLeaks? That was a sigh. It was an audible Emily Bazelon sigh, followed by a slight droop of the face.
I don't know what to say about this.
I'm gonna keep narrating.
There's no way the media wouldn't have covered this. That's just, we don't exist in that universe. Information wants to get out there. Did the media overplay this? Was the story too much on the content of the emails versus our fears about where they were coming from? I think in retrospect, sure. But I also blame the Obama administration for not having made it clear earlier, because they knew these were the Russians doing this hack. And that was not something that was definitively stated before the election with enough alarm. And in the kind of amazing piece that the New York Times did a day or two ago, this like TikTok that looked back, I felt like you could feel the frustration of, well, why wasn't this clear? And that Obama's reticence, his desire to seem nonpartisan, and his assumption that Clinton was going to win the election seemed to have really infected the response within the administration in a way that now just seems like they were wrong.
That's an interesting point about, because they thought Hillary Clinton was going to win, they didn't maybe lean into it as much as they did. But I remember talking about this a lot at the end of the election. I mean, I interviewed Biden about it. I chop up the world now in you know, what happens on Sundays, for at least a month's worth of conversation about
a month
the
of Sundays
hacked emails, the hacked emails, where they came from, the fact that it was Russia, the fact that Donald Trump, even though he was being briefed and 17 intelligence agencies had told him, the fact that he didn't know. Hillary Clinton obviously brought it up in, I can't remember which of it was, her second or third debate. So it was talked about a lot. Now, the fact that this new piece of information that the CIA has determined that it was specifically with the intent of helping Donald Trump wasn't talked about as much. But But this was, this was talked about a fair
I'm with
amount.
John. I actually,
but Obama
I think
never got up there and said, this is an attack on our nation and we are going to respond.
He didn't do that explicitly there, but there are strong political reasons. I think he rightly saw that it would be perceived as a making a big partisan issue at a time when he shouldn't.
If and they had made it clear that the RNC was also being hacked, then why isn't it a bipartisan issue?
I actually think the media mistake is a totally different one than what you're identifying. To me, the media mistake is not, and nor do I think, I agree with John that it was an issue. People did know it was Russian. It was came up in the debate. Trump himself talked about it. The media mistake is the total false equivalence, which is that because of the need to cover these candidates as though they are equal, it's like, well, there's a Hillary Clinton scandal here and a Donald Trump scandal. For every scandal of his, there's a scandal of hers. There has to be kind of this false balance. And the WikiLeaks created this idea of another scandal around Hillary Clinton, even though there was nothing in them. There was nothing like really substantively damaging, but it became, oh, we have to cover this. Mm. Every single day during that campaign, there was a scandal that Trump did that was 10 times worse than really anything in Hillary Clinton's past, but they were covered as though they had equal weight. And WikiLeaks gave that. And that to me is where the media screwed up, was that where the weight of coverage was, not that it was covered at all.
And do you think the media would have done that no matter what? Or do you think the fact that Trump was attacking the media every day and accusing it of bias made it lean more, made it sort of relieved? Oh, good. Look, we have this Hillary Clinton scandal. Let's run with
it. Well, some of both. And also there's just this deep investment in the mainstream media in particular and in the kind of the best journalistic institutions that we have to be fair-minded
balanced
and equitable. And like equitable has come to mean like there's balance, and balance comes to mean as much here as there.
You also in a campaign have two candidates, and so the traditional structure is to cover what's happening in the life of the one candidate and cover what's happening in the life of the other. When you had a front page and you wanted to play up the story that was bigger for the one candidate, it showed up in a way that sent cues to the reader that this is a more important and bigger story. But now that we all read things without a lot of those cues, we read them online or we read them through social media, with the cues stripped away, it looks like there's an equivalence. Even though, I mean, if you're covering a campaign, you have people covering what both are doing. So that doesn't seem to be wrong. That's what you're supposed to do. It's just the ways to signal to readers that one is more important than the other have been stripped away. One other thing I just wanted to go back. The Obama administration did come out. I just checked, and it was basically a month before the election and said the Russians were the Russians were behind this. So that's a month of – and then Biden came out and said they're going to retaliate. The reason the retaliation was a little tricky is – I remember from at the time is that – if you retaliate and let everybody know about it, then you get into – I mean, we are actually super vulnerable to cyber attacks as a culture, as a – you know, because of our reliance on the internet. And so this was something they had to be careful about separate and apart from the election, just in terms of escalating a hot war in the cyber area. So I think there were reasons to be cautious that were outside of the election.
Right. Let's turn to that kind of question of what – as a nation, we do about cyber warfare. Fred Kaplan has a great metaphor, which is that it is true. The U.S. has stronger offensive cyber warfare capabilities than anybody else, but we live in a glassier house. It is much easier to damage us. So even though we can wreak havoc upon the North Korean technology infrastructure such as it is, like there's much less of it to damage. It does much less harm to the country to do that than what a North Korea or a Russia or China or Pakistan could do to the United States, because we just have so much more. It's so much more valuable. And therefore, we have to be very cautious before we do things which are going to cause retaliation. So given that, how do we go to war? This is the new Cold War or a new kind of war. How do we fight this war with Russia in particular?
Whatever you do, the point should be to wound Putin in a way that he cares about. So whether that's his money or his standing and reputation, there has to be something that feels to him like it has a real cost. And I understand the point about fear of escalation. On the other hand, if we don't hit back, we're just asking for more of this. And there already seems like very legitimate concerns that Russia is going to do something similar to try to affect Germany's election. I mean, how many free and fair elections do we want to see tainted by this kind of leaking and hacking and disinformation campaign?
I also want to remember something. why did we win the first Cold War? We won because we had a superior economic system than Russia, which we still do. And we won because we had a superior ideology. Democratic capitalism is the best system that the world has devised for governance and prosperity that the world has ever seen. And that depends on open institution. It depends on transparency. It depends on rule of law. It depends on free communication of peoples. It depends on strong governmental institutions at local and national level. And Russia has none of that. Russia is a crap house. It is like an extractive industry nation. It doesn't produce anything of value that isn't a natural resource and has a poisonous, hateful, authoritarian ideology that is going to lose if we, you know, play our cards right. And so we have to remember that as much as this war is like a war that we wage with the tools of cyber warfare or the tools of sanctions, it is much more a war we wage around ideology. And that means that it's part of our obligation to prevent our institutions from being weakened, to continue to be the shining beacon of light, which Ronald Reagan and the kind of, that was the great insight that the neocons had, or they weren't neocons then, I guess they were just cons, in the 70s and 80s. And we have to remember that Trump is a huge threat to it. And so we have to continue to ideologically represent the greatness and openness and prosperity that America is. And that will win us in the long run.
But wait, aren't you leaving out an important part of the Reaganite philosophy of the Cold War, which was to build up our arsenals and fight a bunch of proxy wars around
sure.
the world?
No, that was a piece of it. Okay. That was a piece of it. But we also had the better story. And right now we don't have a better story. Right now we have a
dimming light.
We have a horrific, you know, celebrity authoritarian would-be president and an embarrassed nation and a demoralized nation.
Who, by the way, makes the explicit opposite case from Reagan in terms of using the story to make the case to other nations.
Right,
When asked about what's going on in Turkey, he said, we can't tell the Turks what to do because we're so messed up our own. So we have no authority to tell other countries what to do, which is an amazing thing that just kind of passed by in the campaign of a million different amazing things. David, you asked about the Russians using our existing institutions and our existing way of doing things to kind of capture us. Or I guess we've all talked about that. So I think there's another way in which Donald Trump has responded to this that is a part of what is in this mix, which is Donald Trump responded on Thursday morning by saying, if Russia or some other entity was hacking, why did the White House wait to act so long? Why did they only complain after Hillary lost? Now, the old response might have been for somebody to take that tweet and say, no, the White House announced this a month before the election, a month before Hillary Clinton lost. So this story isn't coming out as a result of Hillary losing. It was out a month before the election. Now, that would be, you would be doing your fact checking in that case. If you were to do that, I have long believed, you would be doing exactly what Donald Trump would like you to do, which is essentially using the press as a megaphone for his underlying claim, which is that the Obama administration is only talking about this after the election because Hillary Clinton lost. In the service of fact-checking his claim, you are actually promoting that underlying claim to a larger audience, which is exactly what he wants you to do. And so I wonder even now in the reporting about this story whether the press will respond to the new environment it finds itself in or do what we would naturally have done in the past, which was to take a claim from a politician and compare it to the facts.
And what do we do instead?
It's a great question. I think instead, to which I do not have an answer, because obviously if somebody says something, I mean, our whole point here is to build meaning since the Enlightenment, is to use facts to build understanding so that we can become a better society. And so when a fact is in error, you want to correct it so that everybody can stick to the common meaning. That's why we all got in the business, so that people can feel like they have more control over their lives and policy can be better. This is a shot at that. So then the question is, do you essentially reassert the underlying fact just by itself in a vacuum without putting it next to the original
false claim
that is not true, the original false claim? That seems weird because then people will be like, wait, why are you all of a sudden reminding me that this was talked about a month before the election ended? So I don't know what the solution is, but we do know based on just lots and lots of evidence of this that this is a strategy and a tactic of Donald Trump's. Other White Houses have had strategies and tactics that have been pretty similar to the ones before it. This is a new strategy and tactic Major Garrett of CBS wrote about the White House, the Obama White House, using this, what they call the stray voltage theory, which is basically get in a fight about statistics. Even if you know the one you're using is not really on the level, it's fine because you want the fight because the fight is happening on your turf. So that was a smaller version of this. This is, I mean, Donald Trump has made it a more professional and consistent and constant thing to say things that, and not really worry about the veracity, knowing in the hopes that we will all in the mainstream media carry along his untrue original claim.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, has never worked anywhere but at the oil giant. He will soon be Secretary of State if the Senate confirms. Under Tillerson, ExxonMobil has become one of the most successful companies in the history of the world. It is the most dominant oil producer. It strikes deals all across the globe with governments that are both corrupt and legitimate. It is incredibly smart, ruthless, methodical, brilliantly run. The book that Steve Call wrote about ExxonMobil, which I think we interviewed Steve. We did. Steve came on and talked about it on the GabFest. It paints a portrait of a company that is a fascinating company that is built around science and intelligence and the ruthless maximization of profit, and is a very, very, very smart, orderly company. Tillerson is himself a Boy Scout. He was president of the Boy Scouts. He was an Eagle Scout. He cares a great deal about scouting. He is a Christian. He's a lover of Ayn Rand. He's an engineer. And he has done an incredible, irresistible job of advancing his company's interests. He has also been awarded the Order of Friendship by Vladimir Putin, a Russian award to celebrate his efforts to open parts of the Russian Arctic to lots of oil exploration. What is the case, John, that he's a smart, wise choice for our Secretary of State?
I'll give you the Trump case and then the outside the Trump circle case. The Trump case is essentially what he said during the campaign. I'm going to hire people who are great negotiators to deal with these various countries all over the world. And so in that sense, Tillerson, who was a late to the Trump party, in other words, wasn't a booster during the campaign or a loyalist, appealed to his idea of a big, powerful kind of guy like him, who operates in a very, very different kind of business, but who was nevertheless big and powerful and does a lot of deals. I think also there were hurdles for Mitt Romney, all the reporting suggests this was a real – don't listen to what Roger Stone says, that this was just to make fun of Romney. I think there was a real effort to try and get Romney to be Secretary of State. We can talk about that later if you want. The outside, why does Connie Rice and Bob Gates and James Baker think that Tillerson is a good pick? Well, a snarky answer is because Gates and Condi Rice consult with Exxon. But I think the other answer is they believe that he understands the world. He's had a lot of exposure to it and understands that things are complex in the world and in world relationships, that it's not all black and white, and that you sometimes have to manage relationships. One view of Tillerson is his relationship with getting the Order of Freedom or Medal of Freedom or hat of sagaciousness from Russia or whatever it was means he's in the pocket of Russia. The other view is it means he understands and knows how to work and deal with Putin, and that you're never going to make Putin submit. You're going to manage him. And better to have somebody who has some experience in that than somebody who just throws a lot of rhetoric and then fails. And also, by the way, look at the last two attempts to deal with Putin. They haven't really worked, either in the Obama administration or the Bush administration. So have somebody in there who might have some, you know, world experience, some toughness, has been in some high stakes moments, and who has enough ballast to push back perhaps against President Trump.
And it's also another point I'd make in his favor. He's an engineer. Engineers are tough. They're difficult to deal with. There's a lot of problems. There's a rigidity of mind that engineers tend to have, but they're analytical. Kind of analytical rigor is something that seems to be in woefully short supply in the Trump administration so far. So I'm glad to have some of that. Tillerson is not a sort of seat of the pants, do what you feel kind of person. That will probably serve us. Emily, what's the strong case against?
I think there's a question about whether if you've worked for ExxonMobil, this huge oil and gas extractive industry company or whole career, whether you can shift focus and think about the national interest in a broader way that doesn't begin with corporate interests and a kind of private industry way of thinking about winners and losers and gains and benefits. I mean, I really question that. And let's also not forget that ExxonMobil, while it has recently acknowledged that climate change is a real thing, for a long time spent a lot of time and energy muffling the message that climate change was happening or that, you know, carbon dioxide emissions had anything to do with it. The second...
Although, wait, just to interrupt, yeah. It is a sick, hilarious irony that Tillerson is likely the most pro-science and pro-climate change person in this administration so
right.
far.
Well,
he's the only one who actually believes it.
Yeah, exactly. He probably doesn't think we should just turn the whole EPA over to industry. The second issue is this question about Russia. I feel like if he was coming into a different administration that was seemed likely to take a tough, skeptical line on Putin and Russia, then the fact that he had these ties would seem like an asset. But instead, he's coming into a situation where Donald Trump seems ready to rush into Putin's arms, wholly untroubled by Putin's strongman tactics. And as we were just discussing, unwilling to believe that Putin just messed around and scrambled the eggs of our election. And so then you start worrying. I mean, I've been kind of obsessed with the story that after the United States imposed sanctions on Russia, after Russia annexed Crimea, ExxonMobil was drilling in the Kara Sea and they were working on this big rig. ExxonMobil told our government that Russia was going to seize the rig and finish the drilling itself unless it was allowed to continue this project, which the sanctions that the United States had put into place had disallowed. And so the American government capitulated. Exxon finished this project and discovered a major field with 750 million barrels of new oil, all of which, like ExxonMobil, would help develop if we lifted these sanctions on Russia. It's just going to be really hard, as again, as we see with aspects of Donald Trump's business interest, to really hard to disentangle the self-dealing kind of corporate interests here from national security and national interests. I don't know how we're supposed to judge that.
Another piece of this, John, which maybe you have some insight on, this is not at all clear to me if there is a foreign policy philosophy that undergirds what Trump is doing or not. There's been this talk of John Bolton, the talk that is now rapidly diminishing, I hope. John Bolton is the deputy secretary of state. John Bolton is the most neocon-y of the neocons. He would like to, if there's a country he wants to invade it, he'd be happily be bombing Iran right now, probably. And is a huge Russia hawk and just a general kind of protagonist for muscular pushing of American interests militarily across the world. And he was the person who's being put forth as the deputy secretary of state. And then there's Tillerson, who represents kind of a deal making, but doesn't particularly have any ideology. Trump himself sometimes is a very much a kind of nativist or, you know, isolationist, withdraw from the world person. At other times, he's talking about deals. At other times, he's aligning himself with generals who are pretty bellicose. And so have you been able to discern in your reporting and your kind of interviewing people, is there some MO that Tillerson will be tasked with carrying forth, or is it pretty random?
First, if I can make a small diversion, I want to write the novel in which the 1950s plucky reporter's name is pretty bellicose. Anyway, there's not a unifying worldview other than strong American military, big buildup of American forces frightens people from being adventuresome, that the U.S. will be more isolationist than we've been in the past. So, for example, Aleppo and the moral pull on the U.S. to take action in areas where they're slaughtering, I think is, you know, Obama was reluctant to do that. So if you imagined that Barack Obama had, I mean, he did have Samantha Powers as his ambassador to the UN, who wrote about genocide. So at least he had that person on his staff, and yet he wasn't, you know, he only did very little in Syria.
The actions in Libya more reflected the Samantha Powers view of interceding.
Right. That's right. And that's the great lesson for him, which was that was a huge disaster and he shouldn't do it again. So I guess my point is just if you think Obama had these inclinations and then learned from experience that you really can't do all the things you would like to do, I don't even think Donald Trump has those underlying inclinations. I mean, he can say Aleppo's a mess, but it doesn't, I don't think, pull at his heartstrings in a way that would lead to U.S. action. Nor do I think he believes, as Reagan and George W. Bush did, and obviously George Herbert Walker Bush believed, that you need strength in certain areas to and need to take certain risks in U.S. foreign policy to keep the next Aleppo from happening. And so one is don't do anything once the bombing starts. The other is don't do anything if you think bombing might start through instability. So I think those are the two big things. And then I think the third thing is ISIS is an existential threat, and we need to do everything possible to kill the terrorists in ISIS and al-Qaeda.
That has nothing to do with the other pieces. That's what's so crazy is, honestly, what does that have to do with the other pieces? It has nothing to do with it. It's so weird. I mean, because
you're asking
me to.
Yeah.
No, I'm not asking you to defend that. It's just it's like I love, you know, kittens and I love bunny rabbits. And also I love coal. Like, it has nothing to do with it. It doesn't, it's just a non sequitur.
I think you just failed the old analogy test on the SAT.
Well, no, but that's what I'm saying is that they are failing the analogy test.
I know.
But so, John, but the description of you just provided suggests that it's sort of like we'll have a foreign policy, which is we're not going to be interfering in with the affairs of local dictators. We're not going to be doing a lot of waving our hands for freedom wherever there is freedom arising, that our relationships are going to be concerned with sort of maintaining decent economic relationships with strong nations, no matter who's running them, and that that's what we care about.
Right. I guess one other thing I would put in this emerging, you know, if you wanted to put the worldview on an index card, I think a second part to this, don't be adventuresome for the sake of your high-minded principles. I think Donald Trump believes that the Iraq war was the single greatest blunder. I mean, he doesn't believe this. He said it out loud. It was the single greatest blunder in American history. And so I think that shapes his worldview, too.
Yeah. Well, he's not wrong about that in some ways. I want to close with two small points on this. One, Emily, just pushing for you to become Secretary of Agriculture.
Me.
Because if you look at the line of succession,
every
single person in the line of succession is a white dude.
Until you get to Ben Carson. I think he comes right before Elaine Chao.
I think it's the first 13 people are white dudes.
Yes, that's right. Exactly.
The Secretary of Agriculture.
All right, I'll raise my hand for that job. I'd be excellent.
You're a gardener.
I'd be great. I'm really not a gardener.
So the line of succession has 17 people in it. So is it all... It's all secretaries, right? Is that right?
It goes through the Speaker of the House.
Everybody in the cabinet.
And the President Pro Tem.
And then Speaker of the House and the Pro Tem. Okay.
No. Right. I think Speaker and President Pro Tem come before members of the cabinet.
And then members of the cabinet based on when that department was founded, which is why Carson and
Elaine. That's why Homeland Security is last. Yeah. Right. So I'm sorry. I was just trying to figure out when the list runs out. How many people is it before they just have to turn to the cook
well,
there's
this new TV show called Designated Survivor. That's Kiefer Sutherland stars as the sort of an academic who's accidentally ended up as Secretary of HUD, and then he accidentally ends up as president when everyone is killed in a bombing of the Capitol during the State of the Union.
That would be the 12th person in the line of succession, just so you know.
Yeah. Okay. Last point on this, Emily, which is, from your position of Secretary of Agriculture, you can make a judgment about this. The people that Trump has appointed so far, Trump is himself in real estate. The people he's appointed so far are generally in extractive industries. His Energy Secretary, Rick Perry, comes from Texas, an extractive industry state. Scott Pruitt at the EPA is somebody who is a strong ally of extractive industries. Wilbur Ross at Commerce is a coal executive, a coal magnate, among other things. The thing about extractive industries are one... And real estate are similar, which is that they are not actually about creation. They are zero sum. They're about like getting there first and getting a piece of something and taking stuff. And it is really not the model for what economies should be. If you look across the globe, countries which depend on extractive industries, Russia, A1 example, are countries which are corrupt and get poorer over time.
They waste kleptocracies.
Yep. Actually, that's one of the things that disturbs me most about Trump is that his vision for what the economy is based on real estate and now apparently extractive industries. It's a mercantilist vision, and I'm worried about it.
I was talking to a member of Congress who was making a version of that same case, which is basically that Paul Ryan has a different view, and leaving aside whether you agree with Paul Ryan's view or not, but it is a different, like, salesmen and real estate guys have the same sort of worldview, this person was saying. That is different from the worldview of most other conservatives, and particularly the ones who are running the committees in Republicans in Congress. And so it'll be interesting to see whether they just allied those differences and it never comes up, or where and when that might actually intersect as they try to straighten themselves out.
And what's the Paul Ryan worldview that contrasts with the real estate deal-making oil and gas folks?
It's a good question.
I'll say what I think it is, which is that it's built much more around industry and hard work and human capital, that it's kind of intelligence and hard work that gets you the thing, not your ability to sell or your ability to get access to a resource. That is the right worldview. And where I think the rubber meets the road, where the two worldviews clash is around things like education, like how you fund education, what the purpose of education is. Like if you're somebody who believes that economic growth fundamentally comes from the intellectual vitality of a nation, then you pursue one set of goals. And if you believe, no, it comes from the kind of exploitation of natural resources, you pursue an entirely different set of goals. And those, I think, are going to be in conflict.
Well said. The thing that was like this huge, massive thing in front of my face that I couldn't answer the question was where the two sides clash is on specifically on the question of debt. So Donald Trump loves debt, thinks debt's great. Paul Ryan is obsessed with trying to shrink debt and doing politically unpopular things to address the debt and deficit. And I don't think Donald Trump really cares about that stuff. But I was having trouble fitting that back into the original worldview question debate that we were having. So that's why I was. But I think David's explanation is pretty good.
You're allowed to take 5 seconds to think of the answer to a question. That's a totally acceptable amount of time.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is the national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has a cover story in the magazine this month, My President Was Black. It's a long reported essay based on reporting and conversations he had with the president over many months about Obama as a black president. Welcome back to the GabFest, Ta-Nehisi. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me. Is this an essay? Did you feel like it's an essay?
I said reported essay.
I was covering
my bases.
Right. But you feel like that's how it strikes you, like as a reported essay?
Well, it has essayistic elements because you're in it and there's a lot of your thinking in it. But I mean, I think it's like a reported magazine piece as well.
Essay is the word that people use when it's like
high-minded.
It's thoughtful.
So basically, this is not a tweet, really.
Right. Yes. You know,
everything that's not a tweet is an essay.
It's a thousand tweets.
I'm not saying it's not an essay either. I'm just always interested in how people like see things. You know what I mean? Like how it strikes, you know, in this era where like all we have is this vague word long form. You know?
I didn't say that. Right.
You didn't say that.
I like the word long form. Ugh. I think it's helpful.
I do not like the word long form.
Well, it makes me feel like I'm doing my taxes.
Yeah. all right. Let's get to the actual piece itself.
Okay.
So what does the headline mean?
What I wanted to do was there was this song where Jay-Z and Young Jeezy were doing this song, My President is Black, on inauguration night. And if you watch the video, you can feel all the joy, you know, in the room. And I wanted to do something a little bit more mournful. So we turned the is. I had this idea to turn the is into a was. Because I wanted the essay, as you say, to have like a kind of elegiac quality to it. Like I wanted it to be sort of mournful. Like even before Trump won, I think a lot of people in the African-American community, like a year out, people started getting sad, you know, like it was almost over. And I was trying to capture that sadness in the piece.
One of the lines that really struck me, this idea of yours, for 8 years, Barack Obama walked on ice and never fell. It's true. I mean, in terms of how clean and not scandal-ridden the administration was and the high standards of behavior the president has set. So you, in emphasizing how exceptional he is, you really trace that to his upbringing and the way in which it, too, is exceptional. What do you see in that as being the most important for explaining Obama?
Well, you know, I think there's two different things. Like, I think his upbringing really gave him the ability to speak And, you know, this is argument. Like, this might prove to not be true. It's just my theory.
like, you know, so many things.
Yeah, it's just my theory. Like, maybe this is true, maybe it's not. But the way in which the president addressed white audience, I always thought was different. I just had not seen other African-Americans do it. I'm very familiar with African-American politicians or business people or whatever trying to ingratiate themselves to white people. Like I'm familiar with that. I'm familiar with shuffling for white people. I'm familiar for like with flattery. But I thought he was doing something more. I mean, it was flattery in the sense that, you know, any sort of politician has to flatter, you know, the people that whose votes he's trying to get. But it didn't feel I don't know, it felt genuine. Like it actually felt genuine, which was something I had never seen. And so when I began actually going back to read Dreams of My Father, and then when I talked to him about it, it accorded, I felt, with much of his biography, and particularly the idea of being born at a point where in whole swaths of the country, marriage between his mother and his father was illegal, where his very conception, you know, was taboo, and yet he was born far from those places, was raised without the kind of direct traumas that you associate with African-American identity usually. And I thought that probably has some effects.
Talk about that phrase that you use throughout the piece, his belief in white innocence.
Yeah.
That's what you're getting at here. I mean, how is it that he addresses us? I mean, addresses me and John Emily.
He sees
appeals to that.
He sees the best in white people, like the best. I mean, and I think probably as a politician, you have to see the best in like all voters. I don't know. It's like when I was a child, this is just how I was raised. You know, when folks use the term white people, or, you know, more commonly the white man or white folks, it was usually to explain something negative about their life. You know, it usually was tinged with some sort of pain or something like that. And, you know, he has some of that, you know what I mean? Some things that happened to him. But for him, like when he talks about it, it feels much more like individual elements. Here's the best way I can relate to this. Okay. Throughout my entire childhood, I was never in my life called a nigger by a white person. That never actually happened to me. It finally happened to me about 2 years ago, actually when I was in France, right? Crazy enough.
That's what you went to France for. All right.
But you know, like it literally had no emotional effect on me. Like I recognized that it was a white person who was doing it. I recognized that they were trying to insult me because of my race, but it had no effect because I had that wasn't the kind of wounds I had. Do you understand? Like it didn't call back to anything that had happened to me as a child at all. So I recognized it as ignorance, but that was about it. You know what I mean? Like it didn't affect how I saw, you know, the other people around me. I didn't feel like, oh my God, man, I got to be really careful walking through Paris now. Like it didn't really have that sort of effect. Now, had that been like, you know, something that was constant in my life, had I, you know, frankly, been a black French person, experienced that, you know, over a course, I probably would have felt a little different.
I mean, one of the things that was really moving to me about your piece was the description of Obama's white grandparents, you know, who he channels. They helped raise him. He was treated with love and decency by white people as a child growing up in a way that you really highlight and that contrasts so much with the way in which his parents' relationship would have been condemned in much of the country in the 60s when he was growing up. So that, I think, kind of following your thesis along, has left him with this very optimistic view of white people, which was his great strength as a president and also maybe his weakness. And one of the things that's so striking about reading this piece now is his dismissal of the notion that in this moment in American history, a person like Donald Trump could win. And then Donald Trump does win, and you go back to the president one more time, and he's dismissive of something different.
He's dismissive of the consequences of it.
Yeah. Right. He says something about the long-term trends of the United States, and it doesn't go on a smooth, direct line. Sometimes it zigs and zags. Did you believe him at that moment? I have to say, like, as much as I just don't believe that he really, I don't know. What do you think?
I think what I can say is I wasn't convinced by him. I mean, because there are two things going on, right? Like, I think he genuinely is an optimistic person. And I think in the role that he occupies, he probably feels like it does no good to say, you know, the house is falling, yes. The roof is, you know, like it probably does no good to do that. So how much of that is him and how much of that is, you know, him, you know, performing for the office? I don't know. All I can say is I was completely unconvinced by it. The tough thing to reconcile was only weeks earlier he was pitching Donald Trump as an existential threat. And then he was saying, you know what, I think it'll be okay. You know, obviously it's not what I wanted to happen, but I think it'll be okay. One of those two things is not true. Like, they both can't be true at the same time. And so I guess I'm talking myself into what you were saying right now. No, I don't believe him. I don't.
Do you think he has that position because he has to recognize or admit or come to terms with all the limitations he saw in his own presidency from the way he envisioned it on day one, right, and what he sees it now? I'm reminded of that, of his interview with Remnick, where he said, you know, you don't get to write, you write sentences, not whole chapters, right, and you just want to, or maybe he said paragraph, right, you just want to get your paragraph right. So if he thinks there are all these constraints on the presidency, maybe that's what he thinks about this new, those constraints will act on the
well,
new
Well, in which case, everything he was saying before about it, you know, being an existential threat was the lie, you know? Right. But I guess the problem I have with that was a pretty broad Democrat, and to some extent, you know, when you talk about Republican establishment, a lot of people really felt that way.
And feel.
Except now, you know, some of those people who are in politics are saying, no, it's not so bad. So I don't know. I don't know. John, I think you make a good point. And maybe it's a case of, you know, once it happens, you know, you say, well, here's the, you know, the bright side of it. Maybe it's a, you know what I mean? Maybe it's a perspective thing. But I don't know. I struggle to reconcile those two things.
Ta-Nehisi, some of the most vivid and warm writing in this is writing about being a black person at celebrations that the Obamas are having, which are largely that the audiences are largely African-American, that it's music and culture of African-Americans. Talk a little bit about the experience of going to those events and as a black person, what they meant to you and what you'll feel like to miss it. Because I don't think Donald Trump is going to do quite the same events.
Probably not. I remember one time, and this is only briefly alluded to, in the piece, God, it wasn't even that long ago. We're talking about a month and a half ago. We were in Orlando and he was giving a campaign speech for Hillary and he came out and, you know, in the intro, it's about him, you know, dancing and everything. But there was like a thing, like a tarp over top. So you couldn't see the president before he came out, except there was an area you could peek through. And there were a number, it was a mixed crowd, but it was a lot of African Americans in the crowd. And I could just remember the joy, you know, of the folks looking down and how they felt and the sort of ecstasy. And I just have never, it's not like seeing a celebrity. It's not the same thing. You know, I mean, if you look at the cover image and you see how we're focused on those two black girls, like the joy in their faces. And then when I went back to Howard, I mean, that was incredible. I mean, I had never seen anything, you know, like that. I mean, you know, just the way they greeted them. They played a national anthem and then they played Black National Anthem and everybody raises their fist, you know, in that sort of Black Power salute. And it was amazing to see that done, you know, for a black president. Like, it was just like a totally different context than the concert that, you know, we open up with. I mean, that. And so one of the struggles I had was you can be very, very dismissive of all of that and say it's just feeling. You know what I mean? Like, it's just symbolism. It doesn't actually mean anything. But in some way, I feel like you're then dismissive of the people and how they're reacting. You know what I mean? And so you have to, you know, attribute something to that. You have to say that there's, you know, you have to spend some time with that, you know, because I think there's a way of looking at the president and, you know, you only think about policy, you know, and you can have that argument, but I think like he matters as a cultural figure, you know, to the country at large and matters in a particular way to African-Americans.
Ta-Nehisi, one thing I've been struck by in the last couple of months as I just wander past newsstands is there's been an extraordinary number of big articles, big magazine cover stories about Michelle Obama, yeah, or about them as a couple. That even more, there's been even more reminiscence, I somehow feel. Maybe it's because there are a lot of women's magazines that want to put her on the cover. But even more about her and her effect than him. Why do you think that Michelle and Michelle's departure has excited so much interest and nostalgia and enthusiasm and sorrow all at once?
I strongly suspect it has a lot to do with the fact that Michelle Obama has not been called upon, that she was not called upon to speak when Henry Louis Gates happened, when the arrest happened, when Ferguson happened. I strongly suspect because they only know Michelle Obama in a certain way. And I'm not saying I know what Michelle Obama would say, but I think it actually is the flip side of how people loved Laura Bush, right? like liberals had this sort of thing with Laura Bush because, you know, like they had to deal with George Bush, and in their imagination, Laura Bush was milder or somewhat different. I think, you know, and perhaps intelligently, you know, folks have kept Michelle Obama away from that sort of thing, and she's kept herself away from that sort of thing. I'm not saying she should have talked or anything like that, but I don't know. I don't know. It's hard for me to like view that necessarily like as a positive development. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, how she comported herself and how she had to. And I'm, you know, obviously, you know, a gifted first lady, deeply, you know, personable. When, you know, she did put herself out there, you know, during the political campaign and made some just tremendous speeches. But it probably has a lot to do with having not been asked or having not had to answer for one of the most important qualities of this White House over the past 8 years, and that's the fact that they were Black, you know?
Ta-Nehisi Coates' cover story in the New Atlantic is My President Was Black. You should read it, and you should also watch him on Face the Nation this Sunday. He's going to be sitting down with John, so you'll
John
get even more,
ask all the questions
even
then.
More good stuff.
Get to ask all the questions I held back.
Great to have
Always
you.
Always a pleasure.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Now let's go to cocktail chatter. When you're having a beer with the president and first lady, as I hope you will be, what will you chatter to them about, Emily Bazelon?
All right. I have three really fast chatters this week. The first one is my friend James Sturm just finished an amazing series of cartoons in Slate called Off Season. Desolate, wonderful. If you missed it, go check it out. And my sister, Dana Bazelon, who is a defense lawyer, wrote a piece in Vox about these new rules that the Bureau of Prison have put in place that are making it impossible for her clients to have visitors who are not immediate family. And since they're often not married to the mothers of their children, this means that they lose contact with their kids and with their partners in a way that just seems cruel and unnecessary. So
Jesus, that's so fucking
stupid. It's really
stupid.
Awful. It's just so at odds with how people actually live their lives. So go check that out. And then there was an amazing series in the New York Times this week that I'm afraid may get buried in all the news. It's about prosecutors and the power they have over diversion programs.
Plus one to that.
Craziness. It's written by Shayla Dewan and Andrew Laren. And if you didn't read it, you really should go check it out just to understand the way in which these programs, which are supposed to help people not have criminal records, not go to jail, become these kinds of personal, like, banks for prosecutors and just subject to a great deal of abuse. It was really amazing reporting around the country.
Yeah, that's a great series. John Dickerson, what is your chatter?
Since we're expanding the chatter, I'm going to do two quickly. One is
we're all cheating.
I'm doing seven. I'm going to do seven.
I know.
Holiday bonus.
Okay, so one of our shows after the election, was it before the election? I can't remember. I was making the case for watching things in the States. We've got so much to keep the eye on the ball on in Washington now, given all the massive changes that are going to happen. But still, in North Carolina, the Republican Party is moving to curb the power of the new Democratic governor. This is itself its own interesting story, A, in terms of the way in which the Republican-controlled legislature is trying to basically tie the hands of the new Democratic governor. It's interesting in its own terms. It's interesting in the history of North Carolina over the last, you know, 10, 12 years and its politics. But then more broadly, it to me is really interesting in terms of shifting norms, shifting constant campaigning, a level of partisanship that isn't just about rhetoric, but is about actual changes to laws. And so it's just keep the eye on the ball and what's
shocking.
Happening in North Carolina.
It's shocking.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, one of the things that they're doing is changing the way the state election boards are composed to take away the governor's power. And that, of course, is going to be a super important determining feature of the fairness of elections going forward.
Wait, but there's a more hilarious piece of it.
The even and odd years.
Yeah, so they're like, we're going to alternate control the state election board. There'll be an even number, Democrats and Republicans on it. Alternate chairman. So in even years, it'll be just the way where it just happens that in even years, the Republicans will chair it, and in odd years, Democrats will chair it. In even years are the only years there are elections. So it's
yes.
Ridiculous. Anyway, continue. Your second chatter, John.
My second chatter is a piece that was written by Michael Gerson in the Washington Post last week, offering three texts that Donald Trump should read. The first was Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. The second was Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech to Congress in 1941. And then the final one was George Washington's letter to the Hebrew congregation of Newport, Rhode Island. Each one of the texts, and I encourage you to just go read Gerson's piece for why he picks the three. But I thought it was a clever way of making a case basically to about the current moment we're in, which is about standards and norms and what is the underlying we know what the structure of our government is. There are the questions and challenges to the Constitution. Where these norms come from, these are three texts that remind us of who we are as a country. And it's also an interesting parlor game, just like as Gerson says, you know, the funny people will say, well, the first thing you should read is the Constitution, which is what people answered when I did a piece for Slate many years ago about what Obama's reading list should be for the summer. There were lots of people who answered with the Constitution. So this is a bipartisan response. So I recommend that piece to you.
I was thinking when you said three texts that it's more likely that Trump would read three texts that were
text
sent to him.
Messages.
Like it's time for dinner or that was a great speech. I don't think he can get through anything much longer than that. But I could be wrong. My chatter is about a fantastic philosophical problem I learned about, actually, in Atlas Obscura. Sorry, I didn't want a log roll for Atlas Obscura, but I happened to learn about it in Atlas Obscura. My colleague Kara Giamma wrote a story about the incompatible food triad. What is the incompatible food triad, you ask? It was first pondered by a Stanford philosopher known as Wilfred Sellers. And the problem is, can you think of any set of three foods, each of which is great as a pair, but which collectively all three, if you combine them all together, would be gross? So if you think about if A and B are good together and B and C are good together and A and C are good together, then are A, B, and C together always good? So the question is, does such a triad exist?
You mean where there's always good?
It's always the case that if A and B are good, B and C are good, A and C are good, that the triad is always good.
No,
can you find an example?
Not. Like chocolate and peanut butter and banana, or chocolate and peanut butter and mint. Oh, but peanut butter and mint don't go together.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
Gin, olives, and pimentos.
Olives and pimentos.
I don't like olives or pimentos.
Olives and pimentos go together.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And gin
pimentos and gin go together.
No, but they all go together. Olives. What are you talking about? But they all three go together fine.
Right. So isn't that the challenge?
No. The challenge is to find ones where they don't go together fine. Where they each go together well.
Where A, B, and C don't go together fine.
So the best example that's been come up with is...
Oh, okay.
Is,
I like this game.
Is a shot of tequila, a shot of tequila, and a shot of tequila. Which is a genius solution. But it's a great problem which has not yet been solved. So anyway, see if anyone can solve it. Apparently, the main guy who's arguing this now, I think his name Belknap, has said, if you find a solution, please don't send it to me, because he's sick of hearing people's solutions. But if you can think of a solution to the incompatible food triad, tweet it to us. Our interns, Kevin Townsend, our producers, Jocelyn Frank, Steve Lickteig is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Andy Bowers is chief content officer for Panoply. GabFest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest, which has links to what we talked about today. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. Our Twitter feed is @slategabfest. Our email address is gabfest@slate.com. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Talk to you next week for our pre-Christmas show.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.